You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
7 minutes after 10, from holding power accountable to having one of your and my favorite historians in the studio. It's been a while. I was beginning to think maybe she's ghosting me. I check her Facebook to make sure I haven't been uninvited to dinners, but I think she just hasn't been cooking a lot. And of course, we have had great luck on the show that we've had some really interesting historians. We need to bring back the UCT one. You remember the one I had for you who talked to us about, and I don't know if Vashna heard him. If not, I must send her the podcast, who talked about sleep.
Yes.
And the sociology of sleep.
Yes.
Since then, I have enjoyed afternoon naps. I've never felt bad about waking up at 3. Now that I know that the capitalist pigs are responsible for my fear of waking up in the middle of the night and the need to be awake continuously just because the sun is out. Meanwhile, they just want me to be at the machine. And Vashna, similarly, is a fascinating historian because her interests include, just like some of the other historians as well as Professor Makwena that we've had on, looking at society's history through objects, through things, or in today's case, also through food. Vashna, it's wonderful having you back in the studio. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Eusebius. It's very nice to be here.
It's smelling like pickled fish in here. We've got hot cross buns, all sorts of things. I almost forgot that it is actually Easter weekend, right?
Yes.
And with all these festivals, like last year when we spoke about this as well, you kind of forget what an incredible history there is behind it, because most of us, speaking of capitalism, it is just respite from maximizing shareholder value for a couple of days.
Exactly.
And yet the histories and the sociologies behind even things like fasting and Lent, it goes back donkey's years.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And Easter, firstly, symbolizes and is very much linked to the sort of ancient world and the ancient rhythm of time and the change of seasons. So something like spring, which is seen as a time of bountifulness, is really important. And that was marked through a variety of festivals. But just as spring was marked, so was the midwinter festivals. And if you know, around Christmas, there would be these bacchanalia sort of midwinter festivals. And people would just go crazy and eat a lot and have basically a big jowl.
Mm.
But what happens is then between that period of when winter is at its darkest and probably most harshest in the north, they begin to go on fasts in preparation once again for the springtime. And fasting has been very important, and it's been in place since ancient times. The Greeks talk about fasting as a form of therapeutic practice for your body. It then becomes very tied to religious practices, and often very gendered. So women often do a lot of fasting. I mean, we know about fasting for Ramadan within Islam. Within Hinduism, there are various fasting practices, Zoroastrianism, Judaism. So most religions have this deep rooted engagement with fasting. And what you find happening is by the medieval period, with Christianity itself and with society being highly unequal, very similar to today, where you have a very few exceptionally wealthy people and most of the people are laboring in very harsh conditions. What you had happening were the elite women taking on very strict fasts. So for them, Lent, which lots of people still practice today, but for like 40 days, they would start it at Christmas. So at the end of Christmas till Easter, and all they would do was take communion every Sundays. Like, that's all they would eat, right? Now, you obviously have to be elite.
I thought we call that an eating disorder.
Yes, exactly, right? And many feminist historians actually speak to this as beginning some of the beginnings of eating disorders. And it reminds me very much of how elite women today starve themselves, but can, because they're not expected to do very much in society. So you can look like Victoria Beckham. Because you don't have to go outside and labor. Yeah, so you don't need energy, right?
To clean the floors, yeah.
Exactly.
Mavis is cleaning the floor.
Exactly, right? So if you're Victoria Beckham, there's some Polish woman or someone cleaning the floors for you. So you can afford to live off less energy. And these women would also have hallucinations. And they became like saints. And there's a whole movement of honoring these women.
Wow.
Because they would literally have some wine and some bread. And so this fasting and this need to deprive ourselves does have religious significance, but it also has a lot of significance for women. Someone like Joan of Arc becomes a really key figure, but many believe she was just having hallucinations from starving herself and wasn't actually seeing God.
Well, the church then invents languages to try and make sure you don't get an existential crisis by giving it a spiritual twist.
Exactly.
And I laughed when I saw this on my runner. I never heard of this before. I might say it wrong. Anorexia mirabilis.
Yes.
A miraculous lack of appetite.
Exactly. And this is what begins to happen. But what you also have happening is fasting then entering into the realm of politics. So you have it tied to Lent, you have it tied to festivals, but people begin to see its use in society as a form of deprivation and blackmailing, which effectively is what you do. I will starve myself to death if you don't give me these set of things. Gandhi being a perfect example of how to do this.
Yeah. Or as a form of protestation, politically,
yes,
for example.
Exactly.
Conditions that you want improved on.
Yes, and women who often in the feminist movement in the early 20th century who didn't have much ammunition to fight a powerful system would use starving as a mechanism of protest so that they could lodge and hold the state accountable to their bodies and to themselves. So it is so interestingly how it's entwined in and how these practices that are tied to the rhythms of life and nature and seasons can take on all these meanings, religious, political, and so on.
I'm very bad with long historical timelines and fitting them. Every now and then, the church threatens to self-correct when it sees bad behavior. Was there a period when it recognized that maybe this thing is dangerous during the Renaissance, or was there always this interesting attitude towards fasting for sort of spiritual significance?
Well, I think the church tries to correct itself in other ways, interestingly enough, even around Easter. But this correction often happens at times when the church is looking to become much more ascetic, much more sort of in control. Even, for example, hot cross buns, which we'll get to, I'm sure, in a minute, become something that's seen as too indulgent. So when they think society has become too indulgent, even Easter itself, the initial Easter practices were actually split between the Asiatic Christians and the Christians out of Europe. And there was a particular pope who many would consider and is probably considered black today, who basically decided to rein in the sort of excesses of the Asiatic Christian model, which was about enjoyment, about spring, about living again, about enjoying life, Christ, like celebrating Christ's life, and reining it in and correcting it and saying we have to be much more dour, we have to be much more controlled, it has to be about introspection. So it does recognize at times that there are harmful practices, but I think there's always a hierarchy around piety. And this hierarchy around piety means that we are always looking to be the most pious, and we're always looking to deprive ourselves, and deprivation is somehow seen as being good. And you know, there's a very famous Marxist theorist, Weber, who looks at the ways in which, in particular, Protestantism and the Protestant work ethic and this ethic around deprivation becomes a key feature of Christianity and of the ways in which people live their lives in Europe at the birth of capitalism. And I think this is something we really need to think through, and the ways in which the church corrects itself at different periods, not necessarily always for the better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm stunned. I'm absolutely stunned, but not surprised at these incredible connections between religious praxis, things that have just become, even for those of us who are not religious, rituals and part of the cycle of the year that we take out to do certain kinds of reflection, go into certain kind of space, and then the connections inevitably with global political history. Give us a call if you've got an interesting question or even an uninteresting one. Vaishnav will try and answer it. 011-883-0702 in Joburg, in Cape Town, on 021-446-0567. Listen, we still got lots to talk about. We're also going to get into the food stuff. Because it's not just about starvation. The history of pickled fish, for example. How do you make your pickled fish? Have you started buying your fish? I saw some of you on Facebook enthusiastically already getting your fish ready. Do you have any idea where that tradition comes from? We'll tell you on the other side of this.
Eusebius McKaiser on your number one news and talk station.
So Vashna, where shall we go to next? Shall we talk about pickled fish now that I'm on it? Maybe I was just channeling the fact that I'm hungry here and there's pickled fish here. I don't know where this pickled fish comes from. Is this Woolies pickled fish, Megan? Because Woolies pickled fish is very, very, very sweet.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I love, I mean, I'm not so much the fasting type. I'm much more the feasting type of person. So.
There's a different way of putting that. We are gimbas.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not the fasting type. That is the most euphemistic assertion of a love of food that I've ever heard. I'm also not the fasting type, darling.
So
I'm not Ms. Beckham.
Yes. So I'm much happier talking about pickled fish than how to, you know, have hallucinations because I'm starving. But
what I love, right, and you tell the story so wonderfully well, as you're about to do again, is how even particular ingredients have such an interesting history that connects with the histories of economics, politics, globally, spices and that kind of thing. So where does it, what can I tell about the world from Woolies pickled fish?
Yeah. Oh, it's such a wonderful story. I mean, when you read the stuff about pickled fish in South Africa, everyone talks about it as if it's completely South African,
that's
right?
True.
And it's a South African tradition.
That's true.
And
in fact, worse than this, some of us from where I come from,
yes,
think it's a colored tradition.
Exactly.
Pickled
no,
fish.
Exactly.
And there's no D in it. It's pickled fish.
Yes, exactly. And in many cases in South Africa, that is correct. The idea of pickled fish coming, and this speaks to our notion of tradition. So we always think our traditions come from us, as if there was no engagement with the rest of the world, as if we all aren't plugged in globally. Wherever we come from, however small our experiences of the world is, we are always plugged in. And something like pickled fish, our tradition, as many people would say, actually has that same sort of global story. I mean, in South Africa, there's even pickled fish competitions in Cape Town.
Good lie.
And and people compete
really?
From places like Australia, South Africans who had gone to Australia, come back.
Because I've heard of Second New Year. Is pickled fish derde nuwe jaar?
Probably, exactly, right. And so what happens is, in South Africa, pickled fish is very particular. It has really amazing spices in it, turmeric, cinnamon. All of these spices that come into pickled fish is actually the story of Western Cape area, where it largely arises out of. And that's linked deeply to our colonial moment. You know, pickling and curing fish and meats goes back to ancient times. For example, the Dutch in the 10th century began pickling herring. And this becomes a key tool for them and a key source of nutrition when they go on their voyages, when they go on fishing trips. And then as imperialism arises, it becomes a key source of food in this imperial project, that they not only feed themselves, but they feed the slaves and they feed the people that they are going to colonize. And they bring people, the Dutch bring people from across the world to Cape Town. What's Cape Town today, but the Western Cape. From places like Asia, Malaysia, India. They bring slaves. They enslave the local population itself. And together, this grouping of people that come to be what's often considered to be the colored population in Cape Town today. And that story is tied deeply to this pickled fish, the smoked fish. It's a story of migrancy. And it's a story of, you find pickled fish in all sorts of societies, very prominently amongst the Jewish community, because there's a long history of migrancy in that.
Oh, wow.
It's also very much the reason why we do it at this time of the year is because in Europe, after the cold, harsh winters, they would pickle and store a lot of fish. And that is what you ate during your Lent, during your fasting of Lent, and it's the last meal you ate before you broke your Lent. So it's tight. So it's like a long story where bits and pieces come together and reside in us having pickled fish in South Africa today in these ways. And obviously the Malay communities, the Indian communities that were enslaved and in Cape Town in Western Cape during that period, they themselves infuse what would have just been salt and vinegar with spices, with all of this deliciousness. And that's why ours takes on this very particular.
Okay, now you are partly to blame for why I am very reductionist about the politics and the history of spices and
yes.
curry.
Yes.
But it's because I'm a bad student and I like one-liners. Is that combination with the vinegar and the pickled chodunte and the spices that come in just because of, I don't know, the way in which some of these recipes evolve from the point of view of just flavors and stuff? Mm-hmm. Or is it also, as we've previously discussed, that particularly with migrant communities and poor and working class communities, the added benefit, of course, of curry is that we can somehow mask fish that might be slightly offish.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that spices do play a
key. It makes the food go
role.
A long
exactly.
way.
Exactly. It makes the food go a long way, and pickling and vinegar also help preserve the food.
Yes.
So you are able to keep something for a very long time. And for example, while you have pickled fish coming from the Western Cape, in KZN, for example, what you have amongst the indentured Indians is salted fish. So you also have salted fish like snook in Cape Town. Now, that lasts a really long time. And there were people from India who would work on this indentured Indian circuit as merchants. And they would have salted fish factories in Bombay and provide Indian indentured laborers across the whole world
wow.
with salted fish, because that salted fish lasts forever. You just keep it and it never goes off, and you always have a healthy source of protein. And this becomes part of the ration pack for indentured labor in KZN, in Jamaica, in everywhere. So that's why you have in the West Indies salted fish. And it's often very smelly. It's often a very strong flavor. But
yeah, I'm feeling sorry for the guest who's coming in at 11 o'clock because this studio is going to smell.
So it really keeps very well. And it's really useful for working class people, for poor people. And adding the spices shows the innovation that people are able to bring to something that's relatively made just for consumption without care for people. And people are adding the spices. You know, women, this is the work that women do. This is the work that working class poor women do, enslaved women do. It's very hard work. And that's why you find what really annoys me is when people are always looking to food of the elites.
Yes.
And say, oh, this is where innovation happens. For me, if you look at soul food in the United States, you look at food coming out of a variety of places, out of hardship. It comes out of people making do. Italian food, to a large extent, comes out of the food that comes from the rural parts of Italy, the really good Italian food, the hearty food, which Jamie Oliver just very upsettingly calls rustic.
I know, it's your bugbear.
Rustic. I always say this because it's not rustic. It's absolutely sophisticated.
But you know what's so beautiful
layered
about this?
Flavors together.
And I keep telling you, I mean, you should have a podcast on these history of food and things and objects. In a country obsessed with difference and in a world obsessed with difference and identitarian politics and me and my lived experience, we have within the space of just 20 minutes connected the experiences of Jewish South Africans, colored working class South Africans on the Cape Flats, and even Italian immigrants. Isn't that fascinating?
Yes, that's absolutely fascinating. And what upsets me most is that we don't consider that. We don't take that, and we don't realize how intimate it is to us in our everyday life.
Yeah.
In our desire to be me, I, and assume that this is a more progressive way of being in the world, not realizing it fits very well into capitalism, by the way. The individualization of politics. The individualization of politics. It's the I, my story, not the our, not the us, not how have we come together and made this world, not the celebrating
the
those beautiful
absolutely.
Things.
Now let's take a call there. We've got on the line. We've got Tay and Vash, just put on your headphones for me there so you can hear. I think it's Tay. Is it Tay?
Yes, it's Kay.
Kay it is. And appropriately, Kay is from Fishhook, Nohal.
Yes, from Fishhook.
From Fishhook?
Right.
Pardon
yes.
the pun. Go ahead, Kay.
Well, we have a competition every year, the family, my family. We all get together and we bring our own dish of pickled fish and we see who's the best. And I like to think that I win.
How do you make yours?
Oh, it's a long story. I make, the house I put all the spices in there. I also put, apricot jam.
Oh.
Pickles, all the pickles that go into the spices. I can't really tell you all that now.
But the apricot jam, that's interesting. And what fish do you use?
These are enough, and some sugar to get the onions nice and brown.
Okay, but not too much sugar.
Brown.
Okay, but not too much sugar, no?
No, not too much vinegar, because then it tastes, it's too sour. I don't like the sour one. I like mine to have a lot of spice in it.
And then, Kay, which fish is your favorite, if you can get it in time?
I prefer the stock because it's soft and the gravy sinks into the fish. The yellowtail is nice. A lot of people like yellowtail, but I don't find that the gravy and the curry gravy soaks in nicely.
Okay, fascinating. How do you make your pickled fish? And what questions have you got for Vashna?
CBS Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Yeah, the politics and history of Easter food with historian Vashna Jagannath. Vashna, I'm going to ask you to play chef and mom for a bit because you, like many women, have to wear simultaneous roles. You've got to be brilliant, academic. You've got to help Irvin Jim not say nonsense when he speaks. And you still have to cook and stuff. Do you make pickled fish and how do you make it? Or is this one of the things that your wonderful mom makes?
Well, we actually don't do pickled fish.
You don't do it?
No.
Okay.
In KZN, it's not a big
thing.
Big thing. But we do have hot cross buns.
Yum.
And that is a very big thing. And I have baked hot cross buns before.
Really?
Yeah, but not pickled fish. But my mom doesn't.
Okay, but before we leave the pickled fish then, you were just saying to me parenthetically that, of course, in general, right, besides the pickled element and the Easter element, as we know, fish is a very important cameo appearance that it makes in the Bible.
Yes. I mean, so it really ties in very well, the story. It's amazing how we take bits of our whole life and history and religion and can tie it up into a festival neatly. And, you know, there's all these quotes from the Bible about Christ multiplying fish and so on. And also the symbol, the ichthys symbol of the fish was an ancient symbol that Christians used to use to denote when Christianity was underground and highly persecuted, because people forget that Christ was a very revolutionary figure. They always think of him as like kind-hearted, like now everyone thinks of Mandela like a kind-hearted grandfather. But I mean, Christ was against the so-called orthodoxies of the day. I mean, he kicked the moneylenders out of the temple and he was killed because of his beliefs that were very, very revolutionary.
Okay. We must have that conversation, Marva. I want to bring her to debate someone. She's claiming that Jesus was woke.
Yes, he was a Palestinian Jew.
Whoa.
Who was very revolutionary. I mean, you know, from the Middle East. I think that symbol actually means, you know, Jesus Christ, the Son of God and Savior. So the fish is vitally important even to the religious and spiritual practices of people.
We've got hot cross buns here and also the chocolate bunnies and things, right? Mm. I mean, I don't know where this stuff comes from other than the fact that I ate four yesterday.
They're delicious. And I
blame my partner. I don't know why he just took them from Woolies. They're not the same as when you make them yourself. How do you make yours? I really wish I can give some home-baked ones.
Really spicy and lots of
cinnamon?
Raisins, yes, and nutmeg.
Okay,
and nutmeg. I actually have the recipe. It's Nigella Lawson's recipe. And it's foolproof and it's really exceptional. And so that's something I have done before. It takes a long time though to produce. And the history of that is it goes back in written record to the 10th century England, where a monk had decided to bake these and start giving it out to people. But very quickly, you know, during the Reformation in Christianity, talking about the church rectifying itself, there was anti-papacy, like really severe anti-papacy, anti-Catholic Church, and the idea was that all of these things with spices and raisins were seen as being very indulgent. And obviously because spices come from the Middle East and India and Asia, and the raisins and dried fruit as a technology, that system comes from the Middle East into food. And so it was seen as being something of excess. Mm-hmm. And tied to the Catholic Church. So in the Protestant world, they kind of banned it. And it was only allowed at certain periods. And so even Elizabeth I herself banned it. It was only allowed at Easter. And if you're caught making it throughout the year, you could get arrested.
That is interesting.
Right? So it's really an anti, because it was seen as very indulgent. I mean, I think I've spoken to you before about mince pies.
Yes.
Having that same history as being tied to the Vatican because of luxury, indulgence, being tied to the Middle East somehow, the sort of anti-Oriental view of the world, indulgence. We need to be plain and a Doha and aesthetic tied to Protestantism, and that's definitely what affects this history of
when did the crossover happen? Just slow process of what appropriation?
Yeah, I mean, it slowly comes in. I mean, spices, the fruit comes during the Middle Ages when people go on crusade. I mean, like I've told you before, it wasn't just food and spices. They've got science and ideas. Everyone seems to think the Renaissance just magically happened in Europe because people in Europe woke up one day and had an idea. But no, it comes, they discovered that there's mathematics in the world. I mean, because they were effectively, you know, Christian fundamentalists of the day. And Europe was in the Dark Ages for a reason, because of religious fundamentalism. And it's the exchange with the Middle East and North Africa, which people don't talk about at all, where science and cosmopolitanism and all of this resided, and all these technologies that they take back to Europe. And that then, there's a sort of recalibration in Europe against it. But then by the 1800s, it comes back into fashion, and there's much less anti-papacy sort of views in the world.
Okay, I don't want to be killing a sumptuous conversation by deconstructing the bunny.
Yes.
Not that bunny, but the hot cross bunny. Do we know where anything else about it?
Yes.
Presumably the easy bit is the cross symbol, right?
Yeah, I mean, the easy bit is the cross symbol on the bun.
And that's probably the only one, only thing significant about it, sort of, in terms of its shape and what's
on it. Well, it actually goes back to ancient times as well. It predates Christianity, the cross, as a symbol of martyrdom. Because that's what Christ was effectively martyred on a cross, but everyone else was martyred on a cross. Whoever was anti-establishment.
Okay, did you hear that? Trigger warning if you're a Christian fundamentalist.
Sorry. Oh, God.
Historian Vashna has just said the cross, in fact, predates Christianity.
Yes, it was a method. Sorry.
You must warn people that you're about to upset their cherished beliefs. Wow.
Yeah, it predates Christianity. It was a method of how people... That's why, you know, Christ wasn't crucified alone. There were lots of people crucified
alongside. Christians think that they have a monopoly on the cross.
No, it was just a way to torture people in ancient times.
Okay, I must remember that when I speak to a Christian fundamentalist.
Yeah.
And so what was the point of inscribing it on the hot cross?
I think it was just to remember the sacrifice of Christ, and also to be introspective and to think about what we can do and our actions in the world.
Okay, 22 minutes before 11. I need to chew, so that's a good opportunity for us to go shopping. How do you make your own hot cross buns while you are listening to the history? Maybe you're busy making it right now in the kitchen and the wireless is on. Tell us your favorite recipe. How do you like eating it? I prefer it by dunking it in the sauce that I have here with the pickled fish. I'm about to do that in the next 2 minutes, and hopefully I will have swallowed by the time we get back. Otherwise, I'll have to spit, which is not going to be looking good. And your pickled fish, how do you make it? What is your favorite fish? So let's talk food in between talking about the history of food.
Eusebius McKaiser on your number one news and talk station.
Shame, man. I knew at least one person was going to be touched on their cross. Someone on Twitter was on some. My goodness, your hate for Christianity is so shocking. Crucify me. I love freedom of speech, eh? Mandela went to prison so that I can tell you what I think about Christianity, dude. So I find it different. So interesting how some of these festivals, also from the point of view of weather patterns and geography, have historically also different kinds of resonance in the global north. Because I'm thinking now, if we were sitting in Europe, we would not be worrying about whether summer's going to come to an end anytime soon. We're going to be wondering about springtime.
Yes, exactly. And when is it ever arriving?
Yes. Exactly.
Because it seems to not arrive. And in fact, that's why Easter and this period is so significant and has always been significant for humankind, especially in the north, in the global north, because of this fear of when is winter going to come to an end. Because the winter not coming to an end had very dire consequences for people. It meant a failed harvest. It meant the lack of food. You only had so much of food. And if winter continued, imagine you enter into this dark period, you don't know when it's going to end, and it seems to continue endlessly. And in the global north around this time, there seems to be like a sort of, when spring should be happening, there's like a quick spate of really freezing weather, just so you don't forget that spring might not come, and you like live on this edge. And there's this fantastic thing that Hemingway writes in The Movable Feast, which I'd just like to read to you, where he says, "When the cold rains kept on, it killed spring. It was as though a young person had died for no reason. In those days, though, spring always came, finally. But it was frightening that it nearly failed. And that is really important, because if you have huge events in our politics and our history that have changed societies, it's precisely around this period. The French Revolution, the failed harvests, was a huge thing, that impetus that spurred on largely women going into the streets to take up the challenge against monarchy. During the Russian Revolution, I mean, 8 days after Easter, Lenin comes into the Finland station, and basically that's on the back of really harsh winters and failed harvests. People 6 months before were actually burying bread underground to try and keep it from other people, because people were just starving. And so in today's world, where we have access to things, well, many of us do, most don't, we forget about how seasons impact. I mean, Cape Town, for example, with their water crisis, for the first time, middle-class people are beginning to feel what it's like to actually be at the mercy of nature and be at the mercy of your environment.
That is very true.
And they've never had to experience that before. And so that brings up a lot of things and makes you much more linked with what that fear could be like. So you can understand why people celebrate and people have a time to do, to rejoice is during this period, and take it as sacred and take it very seriously.
But it is interesting how it does connect with those continuous struggles in terms of inequality and class anxiety and pressure. In Grahamstown, where you lived for the last few years, and I'd grown up, unemployment is extremely high. Many working class communities, like in the colored community, and my family is, I mean, you don't get more Catholic than my family, complete with holy water when you enter our home. You know, there is this expectation that you ought to somehow miraculously, even if most people might be unemployed in the house, to find a way to be able to partake in this harvest and,
exactly,
and the festival.
Exactly. And you have to find a way to be there for your family and get home. I mean, in the trade union where I work, everyone leaves. Everyone goes home for Easter. It's a key part of our life and our celebrations. And we have to take that seriously because it's not just about Christianity.
Yes.
It's about a whole lot of things. Even if it is just about Christianity,
that's fine. That's perfectly fine.
But it's not just about that. It's about coming together. It's about remembering. It's about taking seriously our life and what we have around us and our environment and really appreciating it. I think that should also be the spirit.
Now, the Easter egg is fascinating, as well as the chocolate bunny. And I think we had some debate once, and I want to talk about both of these and chocolate in general, right? And over to you after this peanut gallery comment. I don't know what is this supposed to, I don't know what this is meant to. Is this the womb? Is this, I don't know, where does this thing come from?
Well, it's fertility.
Fertility.
Yeah. So it comes from Esther, who is the goddess,
okay,
who actually was a pagan goddess in Europe and is tied to, in the Old Norse mythology, there's mention of her. There's mention of her throughout Europe. And in fact, she's tied to the goddess Kali in India. So that Indo-European link is very strong. And Esther is tied to bunnies. She's tied to fertility. She's tied to the egg. Persephone was the Greek version of this, and the ancient Roman version of this fertility goddess. And the idea is that she used to be seen with bunnies, because bunnies procreate very actively and quickly. And what happens is, as Christianity is sweeping through Europe, they try and map on Easter to pre-existing festivals that are there. And then they integrate the bunny. And they take the bunny, for example, to come to symbolize Virgin Mary. Because at the time, the priests thought that the bunnies were procreating on their own. They were hermaphrodite. So that's how it becomes the symbol for the Virgin Mary. And that's how it comes to us.
Slan may do it at the Dimponama.
And so it used to not be chocolate, obviously, because chocolate comes to Europe only in the 1600s with the conquistadors going and basically destroying the entire of Latin America through imperialism. And it comes from Mexico. And so in Mexico, they take chocolate from Mexico, which used to be served hot with spices. And they bring it to Europe, and then it becomes this luxury, another indulgent thing. So the egg, the bunnies, all are symbols of fertility. And the added chocolate is like, after your fast, after your Lent, have some rejoicement, have nice things. The chocolate is added to that.
There's a gay slur that just will never again make sense to me, especially in Cape Town, where gay people are derisively referred to as bunnies. We don't have lots of kids.
No, not at all.
Wow, I am enthralled by this particular history. Let's take a little bit of a break here. We're in conversation with Vashna about the politics and the history of Easter foods. And there's much more to be said about the origins of chocolate and where it enters, Easter Monday in particular. I'd also love to know, what are some of your traditions around this? One of the things I hated the most is that the adults in my family when I grew up as a kid would always be fighting about when the right day is over the Easter weekend for when we're allowed to open the chocolates and the Easter eggs. Don't know about your family, but in mine, for some reason, that one adult who doesn't like seeing children being happy, yes, would insist that it must only happen on the Monday.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, the whole weekend before I can eat.
Eusebius Makaiza on 702 and Cape Talk.
There are interesting particularities of what kind of things you might give during a time of festival or renewal or celebration. And what you just explained to me about even clothing as gifts in some communities is really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like amongst African-American communities, clothing is very important, that people give each other new clothes. We were speaking about, when do we eat the eggs? For them, it's like, when do you open your clothing, the excitement around that. And that's tied to enslavement. And it's tied to how on those days during Easter was when slaves got their new clothes for the entire year. And interestingly enough, African-American community for a while, the enslaved community, used to also practice something called Pinkster, which was tied to the Dutch. Interestingly enough, going back to pickled fish, in our waters, tied to the Dutch coming here. It was the Dutch in the northeast of the United States of America who used to practice Pentecost, which was a sort of after seven Sundays after Christ's death, was they would celebrate the resurrection. And that's when they would allow slaves to have a free day. And so it would be lots of drinking and dancing and festival and bacchanalia and all of that. And that's also tied to many of the Mardi Gras and all those other festivals that come later on. So it's very interesting how this was like global story of people and movement tied to this and what they do.
Do we know anything? It's amazing how even when you know what's coming as a child, you still get pissed off, right?
Yes.
So one of the things that pissed me off with Easter eggs is the shell.
There's
nothing inside. I
know.
Really? This is all the Easter.
Exactly. It's really,
is there a reason for that? Because the one thing that I read, and I know how much truth there is to it, is that part of it is that if I crack the shell, let me be dramatic. That wasn't much of a crack.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. That is partly what a symbol of the empty tomb.
Oh, okay. I did not know that.
I taught you something new.
I did not know that. I always was just bitterly disappointed as a child, especially with the bunnies. And now it really upsets me because I have to buy my son all these bunnies, and they have gone up exceptionally in price, especially those lint ones. And they're also empty.
That's partly because mommy's no longer children. In the meantime, inflation happened.
Exactly.
But the bunnies are nicer because although many of them are also empty, some of them are not. Was there ever a time, do we know in terms of the history of the Easter egg, when it was maybe filled with something more interesting than emptiness?
Well, no, but the history of the Easter egg for the Russian monarchy, the Ivanhoe family, with the Romanovs, was actually very interesting because they would have Fabergé make Easter eggs for them during Easter. And it was not made of chocolate. It was made of jewels.
What's Fabergé?
Fabergé is a very, very expensive jewelry maker from Russia. And today a Fabergé egg would sell for something like $24 million very easily. And the Russians... Yeah,
it's not even Bonang could afford it.
Yeah, no, I don't think even the Guptas couldn't afford it.
Hmm.
And so what happens is the Fabergé, they do smell very miniature ones now,
okay,
but the original Fabergé would be made in these eggs and they would be massive, and they would give them to the daughters and the wives. So the Tsar of Russia would have them made, and they would be filled with beautiful things inside. So you would open it and there'd be an ornate gold chicken inside the egg, and they had the most beautiful jewels. They're in museums across the world. And in fact, on the eve of the Russian Revolution, the Tsar was so unaware that his society was in revolution and rebellion that he ordered the carnelian Fabergé egg. And that was 77,000 times more expensive than what a Russian peasant earned, like in a month. And that egg's been missing and came back, and you know, it was lost during the revolution. But just a month or so after that, they were unseated, and he actually never got to present the egg to his mother, who he had made it for. So the Easter egg has been filled with other things, but not necessarily when it's chocolate or edible. It's when it's been bejeweled.
I've only ever seen like normal chocolatey ones, but apparently also in Mesopotamia, some ancient Christian communities, sometimes there's a red stain. I'm not sure what that would be, food coloring or something, to try and symbolize the blood of Christ.
Oh, okay. And in Kashmir, they make really beautiful ones out of paper mache, and they're incredibly stunning, and they're very ornate, and I have some at home, and they're very, very beautiful.
And where does that come from, do we know?
Well, there is a Christian sort of link in Kashmir, or was that the first
community to declare sugar to be the enemy?
Probably, exactly. But it does probably come from that, and they just made this.
Vaishnavi, we only have 3 minutes left. In my family, my very Catholic family, one of the things about Easter that also as a kid confused me, but you dare not ask complicated questions until you're an adult, is that it's all fish, 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 fish. Are there any traditions where red meat or other kinds of meat
come in? I mean, the fish you have usually by Friday, right? Because it's the fast and the breaking and the Lent.
And if you're a really good Catholic, every Friday.
Every Friday, exactly.
Every Friday.
Yeah. And that is obviously to symbolize the sort of sacrifice you've made. Now you're going to eat something that's not too rich, that's not filled with too much of stuff. So you're not going to have your red meat. Mm. But obviously it's tied deeply to spring. I mean, the lamb has, obviously Jesus does have something to do with lambs and Finn's been a shepherd and all of that. But also in terms of spring, the lamb is tied to the spring lamb and them the birth of new lambs. And so people usually sacrifice these lambs and have lamb on Sunday. Or on the day of celebration. So the lamb is the big Easter meal after the fast. And you also have it's tied to Passover within the Jewish community because the sacrifice of the lamb. So it's very symbolic. And so that is something that people often consume. That's like the standard European sort of tradition of having a leg of lamb during Easter when you sort of the moment of breaking the fast. And this is now you go into the sort of fun times and the chocolate and the lamb.
What happens in your house over Easter with any of these traditions?
Yes, we do a lot of it. We have obviously lots of hot cross buns. And my dad, unlike other people's parents, would buy me the bunny and allow me to eat it in the lead up to Easter as well. So I was very lucky, and I do the same with Rahul. It's very bad form. But we have a big Easter egg hunt for Rahul and for his friends and stuff, and they love that. And then we have lamb, and we have a huge big family lunch on Sundays, and it's really nice because you just come together and you have a fun time, which is what should happen.
Vaishnavi, you've been stunning. I can listen to you the whole day. Love your passion for history and narration of it. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.